But today we're looking at something which is both topical and, in its own right, interesting in the longer term as well. We're looking at the geostrategic divide and undeclared war. This is particularly with reference, I think, to the Middle Eastern region, but obviously it has implications beyond that. Our speaker, who is an old friend of mine, is Alistair Crook, who is the director and founder of Conflicts Forum. He was formerly an advisor on Middle East issues to Javier Solana when he was the EU foreign policy chief. He was also a staff member of Senator George Mitchell's fact-finding committee that inquired into the causes of the Intifada in 2001, and he was advisor to the International Quartet. He helped arrange various ceasefires in the occupied territories and the withdrawal of occupying forces on two occasions. He's had 20 years' experience of working with the Islamist movements and has extensive experience working with movements such as Hamas, Hezbollah, and other movements in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and the Middle East. His book, which he published some time ago, in 2009, was called Resistance, The Essence of the Islamist Revolution. I thought it was a fascinating book, and I think it still has a big relevance today. He's a frequent contributor to the international press, and he writes articles for television, and he gives radio commentaries as well. So without more ado, I'm going to ask him to talk to us for about half an hour, and then I'll open the floor to questions and comments. Alistair.
Thank you very much. The topic, of course, as Michael has just indicated, is about the strategic divide that is affecting the Middle East. And, of course, it does have wider ramifications, as we see now. I think, in fact... Hello? Is that better? I can't hear, so you have to tell me if it's working.
No, now.
Is it?
You have to
okay.
Get quite close to it.
Okay. I hope I don't have to swallow it. Okay. In the context of the Middle East at this point, I think we really have four points of inflection, or what I would call strategic pivots, that are apparent. Now, I don't know which of these is going to be the most important, and so I'm not putting them in any particular order, but what I propose to do today is to concentrate on two such pivots and only give a quick mention to the last two, not because they're insignificant or not because I don't feel that they will not emerge in importance, but simply because I've been given half an hour to speak, and these are complicated issues, and I can't manage more than two. But feel free to talk about the other two or raise it in the questions if you choose. The first thing that I want to talk about is Daesh, or ISIS as it's called in English, because I think it's very important to break this narrative that you see repeated endlessly in the press, that Daesh is an affiliate of Al-Qaeda, that it is somehow, if you like, an offshoot of it. It is a franchise, all this language that you see all the time. Let us make it absolutely plain and clear that Daesh is not Al-Qaeda. There may have been a brief alliance at some point, but it differs totally, both in the terms of how it arose. They have very different points of origin. From each other, from what I'm now going to call not Al-Qaeda any longer, but Bin Ladenism. That may be not a very accurate title. We should perhaps call it Abdullah Azamism, but Bin Ladenism and Zarqawiism. Very different aspects. And it's very important to understand what's going on in the region by understanding that it is not, and it is radically different from Al-Qaeda. How was Al-Qaeda born? Well, I was there at the time. Bin Laden and Abdullah Azam were there. And it derived from the myth that the Mujahideen had defeated the USSR, that they had somehow imploded a major world power by prompting it to overextend itself economically and politically. And it is a myth, but I won't go into that much further. It was a myth that has taken hold. And from that, it became the clear idea that if you could do this to the USSR, you could do this to the West. The great, if you like, the insight from Abdallah Azzam, the insight that provoked this, was the sense of the understanding that actually the great asset of the West, globalization, could actually be used against the West. Against the West by provoking it, if you like, in a virtual way, in a global way, to the point that it would then overextend itself economically and politically in a global context and implode it. And it was in that way, some of you may recoil at my describing this, but it was, if you like, an intellectual approach to the problem from philosophy position. Not at the ground roots level. It was top down. Zarqawiism was totally different. Its origins came from the dispossessed agricultural, agrarian communities, the results of changes in the weather in the region, forced into the industrial suburbs of Amman, into the desperate poverty and the squalor of the industrial suburbs of Amman. And Zarqawi himself, when he moved from there into Iraq, used this very strongly, the sense of really deep anger and hostility and grievance, the sense of usurpation that existed amongst the Sunni community, and the sense of also bigotry, the sense of a deep hatred for those that had usurped the Sunnis from their rightful place, of Iran, of the Shi, of the Alawite usurpation of Syria, of the Hezbollah usurpation in Lebanon, and a desire for revenge. So it was very different. Osama bin Laden's vision was that of imploding, first of all, the USSR, and then imploding America. And he said very clearly, forget, you know, your internal fights. Zarqawiism was about the internal enemy. The internal enemy within Sunni Islam that was preventing it from reaching its goals. But it was far more than this. This is the roots, and this is the currents that from 2002 and 2003 transferred themselves into Syria and embedded themselves around the aggrieved communities of Homs and Hama and the villages surrounding them. A very strong, if you like, sense of hatred and anger, not only just at Sunni and Shi, but also at the urban elite. This was very marked in Aleppo and in other states. But it's much more than this. And to understand what's happening now, you have to understand that there, it's not simply that they're, if you like, a more bigoted, a more violent form of al-Qaeda. They have completely overturned the doctrine of al-Qaeda. It's a revolutionary historical revisionism that we are seeing in Daesh or ISIS. And what it is it undermines completely the pillars of Sunni power and Saudi power. Those pillars of Sunni power, of Saudi power, rest in three main parts. First, in their claim to be the successors to the Quraysh, the Prophet's tribe. Secondly, in their control of the mosque. And thirdly, in their control of the interpretation of the Quran through Al-Hazar or through the ulama in Saudi Arabia. And what Daesh and ISIS say is this. They say, actually, the Islamic State was never founded by the Quraysh. The Islamic State, the early Islamic State, of course I'm talking about at the time of the Prophet or just after the Prophet, was not founded by the Quraysh. It was not founded by the establishment, the caliph and the four righteous communities after it. It was not even founded by Saladin. Actually, and this is not nonsense, there's a historical case. They say that the state came about by fighting scholars leading their own groups of armed men fighting in the name of Islam. And these fighting scholars were also the authority for the interpretation of the Quran. They were the authority. And they were, secondly, in a sense, the mosque. A peripatetic mosque, if you like. Without buildings, but a mosque in the sense of this thing. And at the point that these groups coalesced, we had the Islamic State. This is their historical revisions. I just want to, I'm spending a little time on this because it's so important. Anyone who wonders whether historical revisionism is important can only look at Israel to see how important and how it can shape politics very, very clearly. This is quite different from Bin Laden's view. Bin Laden was largely remained within the Wahhabi doctrine. Yes, they didn't like him inside the kingdom, but it was fine if he said it outside because it was not threatening. This undercuts every pillar of Saudi authority. It undercuts the Quraysh, the claim, it undercuts the mosque, and it undercuts the authority to interpret the Quran. This is really quite revolutionary. And also, secondly, they claim to be a state. Al-Qaeda was a movement. This is a state. And therefore, anyone that challenges it is, if you like, challenging the state. Hence the conflict that we often saw with Jabhat al-Nusra during that time, and the other groups fighting in Syria. What we had in Iraq, in a sense, was a brilliant move by Daesh, who were, in the sense, about to lose the struggle in Syria, with big ramifications, because this is, after all, is a divine project. And the consequences of a divine project failing can be very large. And then the lightning strike into Iraq has changed the whole perception of the movement and its situation dramatically. Some people ask me and say, well, are we dealing here with sectarianism or are we dealing with politics? Which is going on in Iraq now? And I would really say that actually it's the same side. They're just different sides to the coin, the same coin. Yes, it's politics, but it's very important to understand what's happening, because the question is, how come then Saudi Arabia and Gulf states are in alliance with a movement that is directly opposed to their own legitimacy and their standing in the region? And you have to understand, therefore, how it is seen. And the politics is not the politics just of today, although that is clearly one plane of it, but it is seen through the prism of the politics of Mecca and Medina, both for Shi'i and for Sunni. The Arab awakening, if you like, was the leaving of Mecca, the departure, the Prophet taking the community out. And then the big battle at Badr, in which 313 men overwhelmed. And people saw the beginnings of the Arab awakening for Sunnis in these terms of this great. Then, of course, in history came the Battle of Uhud, and the Prophet faced a reversal. He was defeated by Mecca at that point. And that is seen as Syria. This is seen as Syria was the Battle of Uhud for the Sunni Islam in this way, symbolically. Of course, you will understand immediately that who is taking the role of Mecca is Iran and the Shi'i in this. So Syria was the existential threat to the Sunni project for many people. Of course, after Uhud, then the Prophet had a string of unrivaled military victories. And that's what people are seeing today in Iraq, in the imagination. And this, of course, has a resonance that goes beyond young Islamists. Gulf leaders are all applauding this. You know, they may not do it to Westerners too loudly, but many of them are saying very clearly, this is great. This is a Sunni. The Sunni project is past this. So why, how can the, apart from this resonance, how come Saudi Arabia and and others, including the Ba'athists, some elements of the Ba'athists, some Naqshbandi groups and others, are supporting and working with this group. Let us be quite clear. ISIS walked into Mosul with no more than 1,300 men. There was no fighting. There was no battle. It was clearly prepared. There was no fighting. The people simply took off their uniforms and underneath they had their civilian clothes. And no doubt money passed, no doubt some understandings were reached before that. And clearly there is support from many of those Ba'athists and also former military officers who were a part of the disbanded army of Saddam Hussein. And if you go to Mosul, you will see those army officers are principally the ones still trying to take a control of the city. I think the answer, or at least one answer, I'm not sure that I can say it is the answer, but one answer to this is that the Saudis tell people that I know who know the Saudis very well that they feel that Iran has played blood politics in Syria. Sunnis have died. Sunni blood has been spilt. And that they need to inflict blood politics back on Iran. Only in this way can, if you like, some sort of equilibrium in the region be established by which maybe it's possible for Iran or Saudi Arabia eventually to come to some sort of settlement. But blood must flow, whether it's the blood of in Iraq, of proteges of Iran, or directly, but an equaling up, if you like, of course. And many suggest that this will provide a basis for ultimately some sort of solution. I was last week in Damascus and in Beirut, and some of the Ba'athists said to me specifically this, that they believed that this outcome for the Ba'athists that are involved in this project of supporting Daesh, these Ba'athists see this as a chance then to find a political solution, an Iraqi solution to what has happened to the Ba'athists. They feel very humiliated. They feel that they were thrown out of power, ousted from power. The army was dishonored, even though it had reached understandings with the Americans that they would not fight, but believed that they were going to be treated with a certain respect in the conflict. They weren't. Great bitterness and, again, this sense of great grievance and usurpation that Zarqawi, indeed, capitalized on so well in Iraq, is present in the party. Some of them say, well, maybe this, therefore, is the basis on which we can start talking to the Shi'i of Iraq and finding a solution. I think some of them believe this, but I have to say this is not how Iran sees it. Iran sees us in a different light. Iran sees us, if you ask the Iranians, clearly the leadership, they say, no, this is nothing of this. This simply is a coup d'etat. This is a coup d'etat, and it is in the line of coup d'etats that run from General Sisi in Egypt, his coup d'etat, to the attempted coup d'etat that is going on in Libya at the moment, and now a coup d'etat. And that this is a defining moment in the region, a defining moment in the region, and that there is no sign of a Saudi opening, no sign of a Saudi opening to them, and they add, far from it. This is a very serious challenge to us. It's an attempt to break up Syria and Iraq. So what does all this mean? What is this going to likely mean for the region? Well, none of us have a crystal ball, and I certainly find mine very cloudy. But I think it's not likely that Daesh will be able to advance much further than they have. Baghdad, after all, is a city of 6 million, and it's a Shi'i city, largely, now. It's not the same situation. Mosul has a very different character. It's always been a very different character. It's been the source of revolution and opposition for many years. Iraq is de facto divided now. We'll see what happens with this. It is effectively divided. I think equally, and I think this is a view that the Iranians would share, that Maliki is unlikely easily to be able to prize some of these groups, particularly out of Mosul. Anyone who recalls, perhaps some of you will, that battle in Lebanon when there were about 150 of such forerunners of Daesh who took over a Palestinian refugee camp near Tripoli in Lebanon. It took the Lebanese army 3 months and 300 casualties to dislodge a mere 100 odd members of these groups who'd had experience in Iraq and were used to urban fighting. So I don't think it's we're going to see any quick victories. What then will Daesh do? There are signs, and again, it's perhaps a little early, but already last night there were two attempts to cross into Jordan by groups of Daesh members. Undoubtedly, they have cells there, and they have sleeper groups in Jordan. I don't know that this is what they will do, but I think there's a high possibility that rather than coming down south into the Shi'i parts of Iraq, they will move, if they move, into Jordan. Jordan is vulnerable. The king doesn't have a strong support within his Bedouin base any longer, who feel also usurped. And he really hangs in his position by virtue of the Americans. So it is not a strong position, but we will see. What will happen politically in Iraq? Well, I think that we, from the Iranian perspective, I don't think they feel they have to do too much. They have done what they feel is the most important. Soleimani has already visited the Shi'i shrines at Samarra and Najaf and ensured their defense against being taken by these groups. If they were taken or attacked, then we are on a completely different. We're talking about full-scale sectarian conflict. But I think Iran has assured itself that they are largely safe. It doesn't relish or feel the need, I think, to intervene at this stage militarily. It has already succeeded in uniting the deeply factious, normally factious, Shi'i political parties in Iraq. They have been united themselves and united by Sistani too. So the next stage, I think, for Iran will be to negotiate a new political dispensation amongst perhaps a more willing Shi'i set. I know that at the moment John Kerry is going around the region, going to, of all things, the Gulf states, to ask them to try and bring about a more participatory and more balanced state. I think it's extremely ironic that he is going precisely to those states who are responsible and who support Daesh, asking them to bring about a solution in this, adding as he does, or at least his spokesman saying, that of course in urging a wider dispensation, political dispensation, Iran must not have any more power than it had. We must see a lessening of Iranian influence in Iraq. But I'm afraid the arithmetic is just very clear. I mean, you know, 60 to 65% of the Iraqi population is Shi'i. 20% only is Sunni. So it doesn't take too much to understand who is going to form the next government. It's going to be formed in Tehran by Soleimani, probably, almost alone. I don't think the West will have much say in this. And certainly the old names that keep coming up, Iyad Allawi and others, I'm not sure that that will be the case. But it's not going to be easy. It's not going to be easy because, and I may be being somewhat provocative here, but I want to say that I've been very struck how much the West has absorbed and taken over the Sunni narrative, partly because of the connection with the Gulf. But the sense of the Sunnis as victims, invariably as victims. And you see this now in the desperation and the sense that people are saying, well, the Sunnis, you know, must be brought into power and there must be a power-sharing government. But put yourself, and I'm just simply asking you as an exercise, put yourself in the Shi shoes. No. Yes, of course, Maliki has been suspicious and hostile to many of the Sunni groups. But some of the Shi say, well, why did the present Iraqi army walk away in Mosul? They walked away precisely because Maliki had given in to Western pressures to include Sunnis in the army. And what did they do? They walked out of it. And when he looks at what's happening, and the Shi will say, we told you so. The Sunnis cannot be relied on. Here they are engaged in mounting a coup d'etat to overturn the government. Let us not forget that Maliki was only just been, his party has only just faced elections and emerged as the largest party in parliament. How do you ask him to leave office? I mean, he's just emerged as the largest. If you say, oh, that doesn't count, we must have someone else in their place, what are you saying? Let's unstitch the whole political fabric of Iraq. I mean, you know, that the elections didn't count, the votes of the Shi don't count. We can just say that there should be. I don't think, therefore, that Maliki, that the Iranians will be seeking Maliki's departure. I do think that the Iranians also do want and have wanted for some time to try and bring the Shi into into a relationship and bring Sunnis into a relationship. But I don't think it's going to be achieved by simply sort of constructing these unity governments of which are so fashionable at the moment. And after all, perhaps if I'm allowed to say it, I don't know if there are any Americans here, but I mean, perhaps as Obama looks back on his own decision to have a team of rivals, and seen the disadvantages of that in Ukraine and elsewhere, where he seems to have been fighting within his own administration, certain of the politics, we should perhaps question the very merits of teams of rivals being inserted in the volatile atmosphere of the Middle East. I have about 1 or 2 minutes left before Michael thumps the table, so I will just go and say in no more than in headlines, what were my other inflection points in this that are going to determine and affect the strategic future of the Middle East in some way? And as again, please understand, I'm not suggesting that Iraq and ISIS are the only ones. But ISIS is going to be very important. The ground is fertile, not only there, but throughout North Africa, where sort of literal Salafism is bedding itself in, and elsewhere in the region, not just Jordan and Lebanon. And it is seen by many Sunnis as a symbolic politics of, if you like, the Sunni cause marching to a victory. And it's hugely attractive to, particularly to foreign people. It's not Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda, paradoxically, has withered. It has Bin Ladenism is not important. This is the new. This is, so in a sense, yes, Al-Qaeda has been defeated. And yes, you have something that is much more dangerous and much more serious that has bypassed it. That is the reality of it. The second, at least the third of my points of inflection are, of course, the Iran P5+1 nuclear talks. That will be being affected even now by events in Iraq, has been affected by Ukraine, and is going to be a very important strategic element. And the third point, the third, if you like, fourth pivot in the region, is paradoxically Ukraine. I think, firstly, what we see having happened from Ukraine is something that has been long discussed and long hinted at, suddenly crystallizing and taking a real form, which is an alliance between Russia and China in the terms of the interests and against, if you like, the existing global order as it stands today and the existing financial order. Every day you see small moves that are taking place between the Bank of China and Russian companies, changes that are taking place in the role. This is hugely important to the Middle East and the region, this challenge to the, if you like, the post-war global order of Bretton Woods and political. This is going to be important. And I don't think the second thing, that Ukraine is finished. Every day we watch, if you like, escalation of the death and the killing. We're just at the moment in a ceasefire. I don't know whether it's going to have substance or not. But both sides, both President Putin and President Obama, need, if you like, for the great difference between them is for President Putin, this is existential. This is right on the border of Russia, and also this is family. Family in a way that far exceeds what Mrs. Thatcher felt for the Falkland Islanders. Everyone you meet in Russia almost has family there. This is going to be the outcome of the Ukraine issue. Who prevails in this tussle between, if you like, America and President Putin is going to be watched very, very closely. I can tell you when I was in Damascus at that time, in the middle of the war, everything stopped as they watched only one topic discussed, only one thing on television, Ukraine, Ukraine, Ukraine. Same in the region. So those really, I think, of my four sort of strategic pivots that are going to affect the whole of the region. We are going through, no doubt about it, a global change is taking place, a global strategic change. Structures of thoughts are changing, institutions are eroding, and some being replaced, some not. This is one of those really key points, I believe, in history that occur every so often. Maybe the last was in 1848 and other times, where you have a change in consciousness. And I think European states particularly need to look and see and wonder where will be the center of power in the future. And I think that, the great fear of Brzezinski is about to come true, that we must never, the one thing the West should never tolerate is the rise of a power in Eurasia. I think that is precisely what we are seeing globally at the time, a rising of the locus, the center of gravity of power is moving from the Atlantic to Eurasia, and Eurasia that is well funded with energy, resources, and other things. Thank you very much.